It's time for the Burt Cohen Show. It does seem sometimes the dream is harder and harder to make real. It's always been the case that one generation of Americans tries to leave the place a little bit better for the next generation, and it's looking a little bit challenging these days. We have an economic recession still going on. Some are starting to call it a double-dip recession. Housing starts have been very, very poor. And what to do about it? What can we do to realistically pull our economy out of this significant recession? Well, luckily, not just politicians, but academicians take a look at social problems, and sometimes, every now and then, our political leaders, our statesmen and women, pick up on it and use the information. Well, there is a new study just released called Funding Public Services: Best Route to Prosperity. And it's just been written and released by our guest today, economist Jeffrey Thompson. Jeff, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, sure. And for biographical information, Jeff Thompson is with the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And his new paper is based on his extensive analysis of research on what works and what doesn't work to create jobs and strengthen state and regional economies. It suggests a better approach to economic development, one that New England states should pursue as they slowly dig out from the Great Recession. Well, first off, what is the Political Economy Research Institute, and who funds this study?
Perry is an institute here at the University of Massachusetts. We're an independent organization, and a lot of the research coming out of Perry tackles issues like green jobs, the green economy, environmental economics, the impacts of infrastructure investment. So the researchers here at Perry tackle a number of issues. This report was partly financed by a grant from the Stoneman Family Foundation. They support our work looking at state and local government issues and regional economic issues here in New England.
So it's not a partisan-funded report?
Oh, no, not at all.
Well, that's good. Well, your study focuses primarily on the New England states, but there may be applications that could help the entire currently United States. And I keep hearing that New England is in better shape than elsewhere. Is that accurate? And if so, why are we in better economic shape than other regions?
I think that's largely true. To some extent, it's a function of New England is usually in better shape relative to the rest of the country, say, in terms of the unemployment rate. For example, back before the recession hit, December of 2007, New England's unemployment rate was 4.5%, whereas it was 4.9% in the United States. And some of that is a function of the distribution of the population. How many people do you have who are young and old and of working age? And also, even before the recession hit, New England had a much, much lower foreclosure rate. So some of it's just built-in conditions. But also, emerging out of the recession, it does look like our region is experiencing faster employment growth than other parts of the country. And I won't chalk that up to anything. I don't think that there's necessarily any key smoking gun that anybody in the region can hold up and say, we're doing such a great job. In part, it might be a function of industry composition. Some of the industries in this region might have been hit less hard. Their regional strength in education, which I think is a plus to the region, and that might have been hit less hard than some other regions.
Now, so if we're in better shape than other areas, why not just leave well enough alone? If we have, you know, it's a desirable place to be, we have good education, can't we just leave it to the invisible hand of God?
Just saying that you're not as badly off as other parts of the region, I don't think most people would agree that that's good enough. I mean, the nation as a whole lost 8.5 million jobs between the beginning of the recession and the worst point of the recession. New England lost 347,000 jobs. We're a long way from replacing those jobs. So there are a lot of people that remain unemployed. Unemployment rate is 8.5%. So we still have a long way to go. We should appreciate the fact that the foreclosure rate's less than it is in other parts of the country, but I don't think anyone should be resting on their laurels.
There is still high unemployment, and it seems to be continuing. So I wonder if we have advantageous resources that other regions do not, that maybe we're not making the best of them. Could that be the case?
I think that New England does have some important resources relative to other parts of the country, and it has to do with, I think one of those great resources is the educational institutions and the highly skilled workforce. There's a greater share of the workforce here that has higher degrees, and higher levels of education suggest greater adaptable workforce, so you see greater productivity of firms and also greater entrepreneurial activity. Some people don't understand that there's a real strong connection between urban locations and high skills and entrepreneurial activity, and that's something that I think is a boon to the economics of New England.
Oh, excuse me. For a long time in New England, in particular, many decision makers, politicians, statesmen, and women have kind of framed, you know, there are Democrats and Republicans, obviously, and this is an election year, in case some people may not have noticed, but they have framed funding public services on one side of the equation and economic development on the other side, as if there's tension between the two. You know, that some, mostly Republicans, argue we got to have economic development, stimulate the private sector, and Democrats say, hey, we can't forget about public services. And there seems to be kind of a real tension between the two. Your comments on that picture?
Yeah, I think that dichotomy is absolutely false, in that there are a lot of things that the state and local governments do that bolster economic activity broadly for the state. Think about this. You can think about specific examples. So state and local governments are responsible for infrastructure and many large public structures. So say that there's a publicly owned arts center that hosts events, operas, concerts, what have you, that attract people from around the region, and they finance the transportation infrastructure to get them there and back. That's even just from a narrow calculus of bringing in dollars from other states. That is a huge plus for the activities of the public sector. And think about a lot of the range of activity in the private sector. It's things that don't do anything of the sort. Think about restaurants and hairdressers and your local copy shop. These are things that only serve the local population. They're not attracting dollars from outside of the state. So the fixation on private sector equaling some source of growth and public sector equaling a drain on growth is simply mistaken at best.
Well, I wonder how we can address that. I mean, in looking at the New Hampshire state budget, which was very, very difficult this year, more so than usual, it seemed to be a split. Some people were saying, we got to fund public services. People depend on public services. And, of course, what the government looked at, our nominally Democratic governor, John Lynch, said, we have to make cuts in public services to keep the economy going. There are limited dollars. what other options could have been in that mix?
Well, I certainly don't want to minimize the position that governors find themselves in, because it is a tough place. But in terms of thinking about the potential resources to finance public services and infrastructure investment, there are some alternatives. New Hampshire might be the least, the state that utilizes tax incentives and tax credits the least, but it still does adopt some tax incentives and tax credits. And I think, you know, how much of the tax revenue that the state would expect is given away before the appropriations process even begins. So reassessing those priorities and potentially reining in some tax credits and incentives. New Hampshire is in a good position in terms of its bond rating. It could be borrowing to finance some infrastructure investments. And even New Hampshire, while it has a reasonably strong infrastructure, it still has roads and bridges that are in poor shape. Still has some vital infrastructure that needs to be addressed. And even in a state like New Hampshire, the political culture might tend to tilt against it, but there is room to raise taxes in New Hampshire. This is, like you mentioned, an election season, so that's not an easy sell, but if but I'm personally not focused on the political aspect. What my report is looking at is, as a starting point, I'm saying if state and local policymakers are serious about generating economic development in the region, what are the best approaches? And the research suggests that public services, spending on education and infrastructure, are the better way to create jobs and economic growth in the region. And if you want to get that growth, there are some ways to finance it.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with economist Jeffrey Thompson of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Mass Amherst about a new academic report, Funding Public Services as the Best Route to Prosperity. And raising taxes, people kind of automatically think, and I know you're not running for office, which makes it a heck of a lot easier to look at the real solutions, but people often think, how can you raise taxes in an economically depressed period of time? And people, it sort of goes against a gut feeling. People are hurting. How can you even think about raising taxes? Or perhaps could it be broken down, as has been discussed in many places, doing not an across-the-board raise on taxes, but raising taxes on those whose incomes are the greatest, people who have more opportunity. On the other hand, we've seen the Bush tax cuts, the infamous Bush tax cuts, which were supposed to help the economy. What about taxes on the very wealthiest of us all?
If the state is going to consider tax increases, I absolutely think it should consider those taxes that are focused on affluent households. It is true that any tax increase at any point in time really is going to affect people's behavior. You raise someone's taxes, they are going to spend less on consumption goods. But given our economic straits that we find ourselves in, on balance, it's going to be a better outcome if we continue funding vital public services. And here's why. When the state receives the tax revenue, it's going to turn around and spend it all, and it's going to spend most of it locally. Affluent households will reduce their spending by some portion of the tax increase they face. In our study, we use a benchmark, which is a fairly conservative benchmark, of about half. So they'll cut their spending by about half of the tax increase they face. And a lot of that spending would have actually gone outside the state anyway. So on net, just in terms of job creation and GDP within the state, you're going to find yourself in a better position if you sustain education spending, if you sustain infrastructure spending, and do so by taxing high-income households. And keep in mind, I don't think tax increases on high-income households can close the entire budget gap that the states face. For New Hampshire, we've been talking about New Hampshire in detail, so let's use that as an example. I looked at if you impose a 2% surcharge on affluent households, meaning those households with incomes in excess of $200,000. What would it do to those affluent households? Well, in New Hampshire, the average after-tax income would fall from $354,000 to about $345,000. So by anyone's definition, those affluent households would remain quite affluent. You're talking about the top 3% of New Hampshire households, and it would raise a couple of $100 million.
Wow.
So that's a portion of the budget hole. It can't close the whole gap, but it can go a solid part of the way toward preventing cuts to services and infrastructure that really are going to help the state's economy broadly.
Well, that is one thing I wonder about, and it's difficult in New Hampshire where there is no, as of yet, income tax. We have this crazy patchwork quilt of fees and property taxes, but this show, the Bert Cohen Show, has heard it in various different places across the country where there largely are income taxes.
Yeah.
And it does seem that, and again, I know we're veering into the field of politics, but that in this country, people who are not high income earners, who earn less than $250,000 a year, somehow identify with the very wealthy and fight really hard against increasing taxes on the rich. There's something, I suppose, psychological about that. But still, and perhaps we can't get into that, you say that alone would not close the budget gap that a lot of states are feeling. What other methods can be used to come up with that funding?
Well, I think I spend at least a third of the report talking about the benefits and the situation facing infrastructure. And infrastructure projects are typically financed with bonds. And so that's an important way. And New Hampshire, a lot of the New England states are in really good shape in terms of their bond ratings.
Absolutely.
I think New England could afford to embark on some additional infrastructure investments. And that doesn't, those investments are going to put people to work in the short term. Those workers are going to pay higher taxes, and those projects are going to reduce costs in the private sector that firms face over the long run. It's going to have a long-term economic boost, and it doesn't butt up against the balanced budget requirement that the states face. So that's one alternative, and I think the state should consider additional bond financing.
For those who may not be familiar with bond financing, it's actually pretty straightforward. The state is rated as to how good of a risk it is and sells bonds to investor that the income of which is generally tax-free. So it's good for people who want to invest in it. It's a relatively safe investment, especially if the bond ratings are high. And in terms of how it gets paid back through taxes, but very, very little effect on the average income family. And it's paid off over a great deal of time. And, you often hear the phrase, why can't government run more like a business? Well, as far as I can tell, any business knows in order to have a prosperous future, you have to invest prudently, but you have to invest for the future. If you don't do that, your future is a little bit shaky. Now, we've tried tax incentives for small businesses. The study took a look at the effects of tax incentives for small businesses. What kind of a bang for the buck have those been?
Very little. And I'll explain why. But I want to get back to another point at the end of this conversation, which is there are some things that are directed explicitly toward businesses and small businesses that can help them and that have been shown to have better bang for the buck. But the tax incentive approach tends to fail for a couple of reasons. In the short term, what we face in this down economy is firms not hiring because there's reduced demand for their product. And what a tax incentive does is it lowers their tax burden, so increasing their revenues. It lowers their costs if they're able to sell. Right, but cost pressures are not the cause for unemployment right now. So it just addresses the wrong problem in terms of short-term job creation. So really, tax incentives shouldn't even be on the table in talking about how to get out of this down economy. It is a legitimate topic of conversation over the long run. So how to bolster and foster a productive and vibrant economy over the long run. But even over the long run, the research suggests that the tax incentive approach has relatively little payoff. Some studies do find some degree of job creation, but it's modest, and a lot of those jobs, the research shows, tend to be jobs that essentially were lured from the neighboring state. So how much benefit is there from luring a factory to locate on the other side of the border? Well, we're a mobile population anyway. A lot of New England residents work and live in different states. They work in one state and live in another state. So the benefits to the region or any given state from that sort of border hopping is very little. In addition, a lot of the jobs that are identified as being generated in a local place get filled by people who move in from out of the region. So there's relatively little bang for the buck, and what those efforts do, those tax incentives, end up depleting the resources that could and should be used for more productive ends. They should be used towards education and infrastructure, which the region is in great need of upgrading and repairing.
Well, one question is, it does come back to politics a little bit, is short term. Jeff, you know and I know how difficult it is for politicians to look at the long term. It's all just, you know, right now, right now, right now.
Yeah.
And it's not going to work that way. You know, it has to be looking at the long term. And one of the things that has been looked at is cutting education spending. And there was just recently at the federal level a rescue measure so that teachers would not have to lose jobs across the country. What is it about education spending? You say that instead of cutting education spending, in fact, education spending is one of the strongest job creation engines there is. Is that just long-term, or is it just hiring teachers? Or I wonder if you could say more about that.
It's both a short-term and a long-term proposition. And in the short term, one of the reasons why, you know, for example, the state taking federal stimulus dollars and using that to bolster education, one of the reasons why that approach creates and saves lots of jobs is that education is so person intensive. It's most of education dollars goes to fund salaries. There's little in the way of rents and equipment and things like that. So it's a very people focused field. Over the long run, what the benefits of education can be thought of in a couple of ways. The public sector is responsible for the vast majority of all of the training that workers receive, whether they only get a high school degree or whether they go on to college. They're getting that from public institutions, and that training is what makes them efficient and productive and adaptable workers, the kind of workers that firms need to remain competitive. So they're a crucial ingredient to a firm's success. And also, when you think about areas trying to maintain their tax base, for example, maintain their status as an attractive place to live, one of the things that attracts people to places, especially parents or people who are going to be parents, is what is the quality of the local schools. And that's something that if a region or an area has a school system that's hanging by a thread, people don't want to locate there. And that absolutely hurts local businesses. It hurts the local property tax base. So sustaining and even, you know, pushing your school system to be excellent is a great thing for a community or in a state to do.
Well, it does seem fairly obvious. I happen to know my parents deceased fairly recently, and the land is for sale, and it happens to be in a town in Massachusetts where the school system is known to be terrible. I won't name the town. And the property is, the values are extremely low. And, you know, I can't help but think that people see that there's a direct connection between funding education and not. And yet you have people largely on the Republican or right-wing side who see education, frankly, as the enemy, as, you know, the teacher union, as the bad guys, and just, I don't know how much support for education there may be. Did your study look at the quality of education based on comparative regions within the United States, or even with our foreign competitors. You know, it's a world marketplace now. Do other countries value education more? And is there empirical evidence to show that, yeah, when you invest in education, your economy does better?
Well, that sort of international comparison is really beyond the scope of my work, or this paper especially. Although I did see a recent OECD report that looked internationally at spending on education, and they came away, and OECD is a very mainstream, arguably, you know, center-right, sort of mildly conservative outfit,
and that's the office,
but very well respected, and they came to a fairly strong conclusion that across their cross-country comparison suggested that investments in spending in education have a very strong payoff in terms of increasing the income and employment in regions. So I think the evidence is definitely there. My paper does look with comparing different states, again with a focus on New England, about what the investments that different states are making in education, what the spending per pupil is, what the graduation and dropout rates are. And a lot of those dimensions, especially at the K-12 level, New England does look fairly good. New England has lower dropout rates, higher test scores, and does spend more on a per capita basis relative to most other states on its K-12 education. Where New England really falls down compared to other states is the higher education system. New England states invest far less in higher education than most other states. Really, they rank near the bottom of the pile.
Yeah.
And they also charge much higher tuition. So I think every New England state has higher tuition than the national average. It depends on what portion of the education world you look at. But even in K-12, like I said, where there are some really good outcomes, you still have schools that are in trouble. You still have states. Rhode Island, for example, has high dropout rates and low test scores relative to the country. So within the region, there's lots of variation. And even in a high test score state like New Hampshire, you still have a lot of kids scoring very poorly. For example, even in Massachusetts, 15% of eighth graders scored below basic levels.
Oof.
In math, 17% scored below basic levels in reading attainment. So there, even in the areas that have strong school systems, there still is room for improvement.
Well, it's also true that a lot of the students don't even bother taking the tests because they don't see any hope for the future. And why bother taking these SAT tests? They're not going to go on to college. They can't afford it. So I think there's some skew in there as well. Are there other areas of the United States that are known for investing in K-12 as well as higher education, and you can show a direct correlation between economic strength and not?
Well, identifying those relationships can be tough. But before I get to that complexity, I will say that some of the states with the highest, for example, per pupil spending in K-12, New York, New Jersey are ranked at the top. Wyoming is actually a state that spends a lot per pupil. At the bottom of the rung, you have Nevada, Idaho, and Utah. So some of, if you wanted to draw a simple connection by saying, you know, what's the spending rank on K-12 education and what's the economic growth rank, you can't really make that leap for a couple of reasons. The reasons are that some of the areas that are growing fastest are areas with fewest kids. Some of the areas in the country that grow fast historically have been areas with very low property values. The whole movement out west, the east was settled first, property values were higher, and so people moving to low property values.
Right.
So identifying what causes what is a lot harder than just looking at that simple correlation. The studies that are trying to take seriously what are the actual effects of spending more in education end up being more complicated, and try to, in a social science context, adopt you know, as close to they can as sort of experimental conditions, making sure that the comparisons are from apples to apples.
Uh-huh. But you, Jeff, feel comfortable in saying, based on your research, that investing in public education is a wise investment, and, you know, in times of economic distress, it's not a good decision to cut education, that now may be a better time to invest in education. You feel fairly confident that your report shows that.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel very strongly about that. I mean, there are two parts to it. First of all, just based on the patterns of how states spend money and how households spend money, we know that in the short term, by bolstering the education system, you're going to keep more people in jobs. Over the long run, we know that these investments have payoff. Some of the evidence reviewed in the paper looks at actual bona fide experiments, you know, tracking people over many, many years, random assignment, giving some sets of students improved educational services and leaving other students in the standard educational approach, tracking them for decades and looking at what their success is in terms of achieving higher rates of graduation, higher rates of job finding, lower unemployment, and higher earnings. So we know from very rigorous social science that these investments do pay off and do improve the economy and improve the lives of the students who benefit from those improved services.
And wouldn't it be nice to have politicians who had some courage to recognize that and perhaps go against the prevailing winds? I swear, history shows that politicians who do that make out well. People are looking for that. They really do. I don't know why they don't try that. Something like a backbone, you know, would be a good thing. But speaking of backbone, there is infrastructure. Now, how's that for a segue to roads, bridges, dams, energy transmissions, drinking water? We rely on these things. And if you travel across anywhere in the country, bridges are really risky. You know, the former transportation secretary here in New Hampshire said a long time ago, in terms of the quality of our bridges, drive fast and don't look back. As you're going over the bridges. Tell us what your study says about investments in terms of long-term payoff, as well as perhaps short-term payoff in roads, bridges, dams, energy transmissions, green investments, drinking water. We have tremendous needs here.
Yeah, there is a lot of need. In New England, the figures show that 40% of bridges are structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. In terms of the number of dams that are high or significant hazard potential, you know, you're talking hundreds of dams, and anywhere between a quarter to two-thirds of roads, depending on which state you look at, are in poor or mediocre condition. So the need is great. And in terms of the payoff, there's a short-term and there's a long-term dimension. The short-term is just something that I think everyone can relate to. It's the putting people, putting tools in people's hands and putting them to work. You know, the most visible one is, you know, road paving, which we can all see.
Right.
Bridge repair, you can see the workers at work while they're doing it. So those workers turn around and spend that money in their local grocery stores, local services, and those stores benefit from that spending. So there's a spillover effect that amplifies the jobs, and it's further aided by the fact that a lot of these infrastructure projects get federal matching dollars. So
yes,
it's a fairly potent way of boosting short-term employment. There's also a long-term dimension,
yeah,
that is a little more nuanced, but the research has pretty strongly supported as well. You know, what having a reliable and a smoothly functioning transportation infrastructure does is households benefit from it in that they're able to get places quicker. They get places quicker, they spend less in gas, they waste less time waiting. And the same is true for firms, you know, shipping goods and products around the region, whether it's receiving inputs to their manufacturing process or shipping their goods to market. Having a smoothly functioning port facility, they're able to shrink turnaround time. I mean, there's a number of ways in which transportation infrastructure lower the costs faced by firms. And it's those long-term costs that firms take into consideration when they're thinking about starting up or shutting down or expanding. So, and the research on this question has consistently showed that states that boost their infrastructure lower costs for the firms in those states and generate employment and increased economic activity in the region.
Boy, it sounds so common sense. You know, where does a business want to locate? They want to bring employees in and make them happy, so the schools are important, and there has to be a way to get from home to job. What a concept. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with economist Jeffrey Thompson of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Mass Amherst about his new study. Did your study measure the success level of the Obama stimulus? Was it too little, too much of half an effort? It seemed to me that, you know, there are all these signs out there saying that this is part of the economic stimulus. Was that the right step, too little of a step? And what are your assessments of that?
That's not really part of the study. I mean, I have some thoughts on it. You know, what the study starts out by saying is that, before I get on to answering your question directly, is that part of the point of the study is to identify ways that states can address these problems. But anything the states do, you know, even if, you know, state policymakers pick the study up and act it accordingly, you know, based on what I'm suggesting are the best approaches, they still can only do so much, in part because they're bound by balanced budget requirements. And they have just much smaller regions. It's really the federal government that is, and it appropriately is, the primary driver in terms of economic stimulus, both in terms of monetary policy and in terms of fiscal policy. So having said that, what the Obama administration's steps were very positive. I mean, the recent evidence suggests that the ARRA, Stimulus Act, generated between 1.4 and 3.6 million jobs in the third quarter of 2010. So we know it's had an impact, but there's also very good reason to think that even those efforts were too small. And there were a lot of people, and very smart people, who had been saying from the beginning that this stimulus was too small. In fact, when people identified, and I don't have all these numbers at the tip of my tongue, identified even at the time of the anticipated increases in unemployment that we were facing, that before the ink was dry on that bill, that the size of the stimulus was too small to close the gap in terms of the decreased employment we were expecting and how many people we needed to put to work. And after the ink was dry, the economy deteriorated further before the stimulus dollars could even get out. So conditions on the ground were deteriorating rapidly. So when you combine those two shortfalls, you know, what we knew before the bill became law and how much worse things got between the time the bill became law and when the money went out the door, the era and the stimulus efforts were just too small.
It's frustrating, and in that case, certainly, it's easy to see why some people say the Obama stimulus didn't work. And one of the pitfalls of being bipartisan is that, well, you compromise and you try to get the votes you need out of the 435 members of Congress and the 100 senators. And in doing so, it's oftentimes just half a loaf, which I suppose is better than no loaf at all. But people seem, my sense is, and I guess this is just my sense, I don't know what you make of it, but people, the current political opinion seems to be that, maybe it didn't work so much. Maybe it was a waste of money. And then, of course, there are the bailouts for the big banks, which everybody seems angry at. But there was also bailout for General Motors, which seemed to have worked. What about that aspect of, and again, this may be a little bit outside the study, but providing tax breaks and actual bailouts to big corporations? Or is there some way, would it make more sense to actually just have the government itself be the employer of last resort, basically, and just invest in actual public projects like FDR's New Deal?
I think that that would have been, and I don't think it's too late because we're anticipating, you know, high unemployment for a couple of years to come at least. You know, that's if we don't fall into a double dip recession. But if that had been a part of the package from the get-go, I think that would have been a very positive step. The Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Put together a fairly comprehensive stimulus package proposal, and that was a big part of it. And it really goes hand-in-hand with some of the things I'm identifying in the report in terms of the needs, the unmet needs for infrastructure improvement in the region. You know, if there had direct public employment, especially when you're facing 10% unemployment, really does have a room, has room. And also, you know, one of my, the director of Perry, Bob Poland, has identified some fairly innovative ways to boost economic activity beyond, you know, another round of stimulus, which is absolutely required regardless of the political realities in the U.S. Senate. It's required, but also there can be steps for the government to essentially short-circuit the financial system in a sense of doing providing some direct lending to firms or doing loan guarantees. There's a lot of money in the financial system that is just essentially stocking up, a lot of financial firms stockpiling reserves and not lending as much as they need. So firms out there wanting to expand, wanting to increase the number of increased shifts, et cetera, buy new facilities, invest further. A lot of firms out there having a hard time. And so that's an additional sort of inventive or creative way that the federal government could take additional steps to generate a lot of jobs.
So, Jeff, it sounds like you're talking about if, all right, the government could create jobs directly, more directly than was done with the stimulus, a la FDR's New Deal. But also you're making the point about making capital more available to small business.
Yeah.
Why don't they do that?
I can't give the definitive answer. I mean, I think that, you know, if you can't get an old-fashioned traditional, think about how difficult it has been to simply extend unemployment benefits.
True. Good point.
That's something that's already built into the system that has huge, broad popular appeal, and everyone understands.
Yeah.
And even that has been hard, just given political realities. So I think, you know, the whys as to some other innovative approaches not being explored, I don't think you have to move much beyond politics to explain why not. Those aren't very good reasons in terms
right.
of the public well-being and what you actually want to do to generate economic growth, but I don't know if we need to go beyond politics to explain why not.
It's just incredible here why even people on the right wouldn't be pleased if the government, instead of, you know, there's this anger at bailing out AIG and the big banks, you know, too big to fail. And yet, I would think it would be popular and sensible to take, you know, a billion here, a billion there, as they say, pretty soon you're talking real money, and to make that available in low interest loans to people. That's capitalism. And I have a hard time understanding that. Now, of course, we have something called deficit hawks. People are screaming about the deficit. Now, politically, it doesn't generally matter how people vote, but there are a lot of deficit hawks out there, or as one of my previous guests, James K. Galbraith, called them, deficit peacocks. Not hawks, deficit peacocks, because they're strutting around about the deficit. And yet when Bush was president, you know, the deficit was huge. I mean, we have these two very expensive wars that don't seem to be working. And it was the tax cuts for the very wealthy. What can you say to the deficit hawks who say, oh, my God, we can't invest in the public good and public investment in infrastructure and education?
I'd say those priorities are just fundamentally misplaced. You don't need to dismiss the importance of paying attention to a deficit. But if you want to understand what our deficit looks like currently and the deficit situation we're facing over the next decade, if you actually look at the numbers and you're being an honest person, you're forced to accept that the stimulus efforts play essentially zero role in our long-term deficit. They play a role this year and next year, yes, but after that they completely vanish. To the extent we have contributing factors to our long-term deficit, it has to do with the Bush tax cuts, it has to do with financing two wars, and it has to do with the sort of the lingering hangover from facing such a deep economic recession. So stimulus, you can, as an honest person, you can both say, I'm concerned about the deficit, and I want to dramatically expand stimulus efforts. Doing both things is entirely consistent. You know, what you want, you don't need to have zero deficit. In fact, if you had zero deficit, you would, you know, probably be in trouble. You want to maintain manageable deficits. You don't want to have zero debt. And your deficits can exist, but they just can't be shooting out of control as far as the eye can see when you look down the time horizon. And getting the long-term deficit under control, that's relevant. We have to address rising medical costs. We have to consider our foreign adventures in terms of war. We have to address these tax cuts, but it has nothing to do with current stimulus.
Interesting. You bring up the point about medical care. Health insurance is very expensive, and it's been, correct me if I'm wrong, I would think the high cost of health insurance is an obstacle to economic development, is it not?
Oh, absolutely it is. I mean, this whole question about what to think about economic development from the framework of a firm or a small business, a lot of the truths you come to run counter to a standard, you know, right-wing narrative, if you will, in that firms value local education services. They need to have reliable workers. Firms, in hiring workers, they need to be able to be competitive in a world where people need health care, need health insurance. Firms need to have affordable health care. And if they don't have that, they're always going to be at a disadvantage with larger firms. They're going to be at a have difficulty offering those benefits. Those eat up an increasingly large share of a firm's resources every year in, year out. So taming the beast, if you will, of increasing medical costs year in, year out is vital for businesses.
And there's been a start at doing that. It may be too little, too late. I'm not sure. You are listening to the Bert Cohen Show, where we're talking with economist Jeff Thompson of the Political Economy Research Institute at UMass about funding public services. You hear a lot of talk these days, again, getting back to politics, socialism. The boogeyman of socialism is out there. People on the right generally are screaming that Obama is a socialist. Is what you're talking about, Professor Thompson, socialism?
Hardly. You know, that kind of talk just completely avoids dealing with any issues that we're facing in the real world. You know, state and local governments employ school teachers, they employ firefighters, policemen, they employ people who operate and who create infrastructure projects. And they employ a few, you know, a small cadre of workers to staff the bureaucracy of the state, and social workers, a few of those. But typically it's states spend their money in terms of providing health care and education. Those are the two big things. You know, the bringing up socialism in the modern American context, you know, basically anyone who brings it up essentially signals that they're not remotely interested in having a real conversation about the issues that we're facing. You know, socialism historically has been the state, controlling the means of production in those old terms.
Right.
You know, the Obama administration, as far as I can tell, has zero interest in that. And I think any honest observer would be forced to admit it. You know, to see how his economic team was dragged kicking and screaming into those bailout efforts, is, I think, evidence that that's not remotely of interest. And just consider who actually has the political authorship, if you will, of different approaches. You know, consider that the TARP program was a Bush administration vestige.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to the extent that the federal government has taken some ownership stake in firms, those are going to be turned around and sold at the earliest convenience, and that's something that
sure.
we can count on.
And they're paying them back. GM is doing remarkably well. They're paying them back. It's good business. What a concept. And I guess we're coming up toward the end of the hour. What happens, look in the crystal ball, a little dangerous here, what happens to America's economy and competitiveness in the world if we do not invest, if we continue on the same, well, I don't know which course we're on, actually, but if we fail to invest appropriately in such specifics as education and infrastructure improvement, what do you think happens to us?
Well, you know, I don't like to be thinking too much too far down the road, and being too pessimistic are really not in my nature. But suffice to say that a vital ingredient in terms of success in a modern economy is some of those vital ingredients are innovation. They are high-skilled adaptive workforces. As a nation, to sustain a high standard of living and remain competitive economically, we have to invest in those areas which make our firms and our workers competitive. There's just no alternative. To turn around and run from those requirements, relegates us to a world where we can't compete, where our standard of living declines dramatically. And I think that would be a colossal mistake. In terms of thinking about how we fare relative to the rest of the world, it is very true that this economic recession that we're in is shared by many countries.
Yes.
So we're not the only ones struggling with high unemployment. But if we can guarantee even harder times ahead if we don't, make sure to sustain these key investments.
And have you had the ear of elected officials? Have they seen, have they looked at this report? Have they paid attention to it? And what can the average person do, people who might be listening to this, to make what you're talking about reality?
Well, I think some of the things that come away from the report in terms of what your typical person, I think there's some just fundamental notions that are in the public dialogue that are wrong. And some things we hit on earlier, the idea that state spending somehow is a drain. The report, I think, urges people to seriously consider what things the state and local governments actually do, and identifying, oh, the schools. Yes, of course that's where the state spends its money. We want the schools. People understand the benefit of schools. Businesses understand the benefits of roads and bridges. So if in their conversations with coworkers and neighbors and family members, when someone starts to expound on the evils of government, ask people to pin people down. So by the evils of government, do you mean the schools that train the workforce, the schools that train our kids? Do you mean the bridges that we drive on? Because that's government. So if the evils of government, what is it? So forcing people to sort of exit the politically driven fantasy world and sort of ground themselves in the real world of what state and local governments actually do, that would be a huge boon. As far as local, elected officials looking at the work, I think there's been a pretty good media release of this report in terms of it being picked up in papers. So I know elected officials have seen it, but I've had no personal interaction. These are issues that I think elected officials, many of them, know and understand and are having a difficult time wanting to sustain these investments in the face of a tough political environment.
Yeah.
So my heart does really go out to many of them. They're in a hard place.
They are indeed. Well, I'm glad I'm not running this year. If people are interested in finding more about this study, I assume there's a website you can point them to. Are you there?
Yes, perry.umass.edu. Sorry.
Oh, easy enough. Perry, say that again, Perry.
Yeah, P-E-R-I
yeah.
dot U-M-A-S-S perry.umass.edu. So perry.umass.edu. The report is there.
Thank you so much, Professor Thompson, for being with us today on The Bert Cohen Show. And let's hope some good common sense reality comes into play when creating the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
All right. And I look forward to your emails, bert@thebertcohenshow.com. Thanks very much for listening. This is about work. The Work Song, Butterfield Blues Band. They go on and on. The great Paul Butterfield Blues Band from the album East West. Thanks very much for listening to The Bert Cohen Show.